And welcome to this roundtable discussion session, listening to learners about their student experience of US outreach and student support programs. I'd like to welcome our panel from my left, your left, Mr. Michael Alessandro Jeffries, who's the program director for MEAR at the University of Central Florida. Sitting next to him, Lucy Rinchner, also from UCF. Emily Madurino from University of Kansas, Esteban Santos from UCF, Jessica from University of Kansas, and last but not least, Alma also from UCF. Well, the McNair experience. They're going to tell you a little bit about it and give you their insights and experience as scholars on this program. Their learning journey, to use that metaphor, tell you a little bit about their insights and how this program has actually changed their lives and their dispositions towards learning. As SPACE members, we're members of a particular community of practice, to use Leyden Wenger's term. And over the past 2 years, continuing, my research unit has been working with people like Michael and other McNair directors to help devise a bespoke program that fits in with the McNair program in the States to give these scholars an opportunity to experience research in the UK as well as attend conferences such as this one. But it also helps develop and challenge them to move from what we might call peripheral to actually more legitimate forms of participation. The format for this session is really simple. I'm going to shut up in a minute. I'm going to hand over to the scholars. They're going to talk for about 25 minutes to maybe half an hour, and then it's over to you, not just for a Q&A session, but we actually want a real discussion. We want to have a debate about how this practice might translate perhaps to the UK, to England, to Scotland, so it's a bit of policy, import and export, some of the challenges that they face in maintaining these programs. So without further ado, I'll hand over to you, Michael.
Thank you, Mike. And welcome to all. It's been a great pleasure for us to be here at the FACE conference. And I'm going to be quiet in just a minute and really turn over to the students who are the participants, obviously, within the program and can tell you a little bit about it. But what I wanted to do was just to start off and tell you a little bit of context in terms of the McNair program and how we're funded through the U.S. Department of Education as part of a larger TRIO program and what that means, and the scholars will go into it a little bit in just a few minutes. Like Tony said, my name is Michael Alessandro Jeffries. I'm the director of the McNair Scholars Program and another outreach program that's fused around research and graduate school preparation for students that are first generation, low income, and groups underrepresented at the PhD level. So my sole purpose at the University of Central Florida is to work with underrepresented populations to get them out of UCF and into graduate school so that they're able to kind of create mirrors in front of the classroom, in industry, with the PhD, and also through the research that they're doing. A major part of what we do within the program is to help the students create a legacy for themselves, their family, their community, and making sure that each of them, as they come into the program and go out of the program, have an understanding of what the PhD will mean for themselves, their family, and also their community as they move forward. A little background about UCF. It's located in Orlando, Florida. It's currently the second largest institution in the U.S. We have about 56,000 students. A large majority of those students are transfer students that come in as community college transfer for the states. A lot of students that are first generation find their entryway into higher education in the community college because of price, also because of location, proximity to home. And so a larger number of our students come in as community college transfers, and a large majority of our students are the first in their families to go to the institution. And so for a lot of us, the agenda that you have with WP here resonates very well in terms of our institution and the programs that we have at UCF. When we look at McNair, again, McNair is funded through the U.S. Department of Education and as part of the TRIO programs, which is a larger group of organization that's focus is to create seamless education for students at all entry points throughout their career. It was established in the 1960s. Through Congress, U.S. Congress, and really looked at educational opportunities for first-generation and low-income college students and families to, again, have access to education. It originally started with three programs, hence the name TRIO, with talent search, which you'll hear about, student support services, and also Upward Bound. And when we talk about first generation in terms of the TRIO programs, it is just the broad definition that for the students, either their parents or their legal guardian had not graduated with a college degree. So with that, I'll hand it over to the scholars who will continue on with the journey.
Hello, everyone. My name is Lucy Rincher. I am going into my last year as an undergraduate at the University of Central Florida. My major is Communication, Science, and Disorders. My research topic is focused around basically communication and minority populations, like multilingual populations, and basically their access to higher education and how do, how does the school system accommodate their needs, being that they're either multilingual or have a speech or language disorder, and basically how that's addressed in higher education or just in education in general. In the future, I want to go on and get a master's in speech-language pathology. In my major, it's necessary. I can't bypass that. I have to get a master's degree, and then I have to go, and I'd like to go on and get a PhD. Right now, I'm looking at the area of communication and culture. That's what I'm interested in. And Michael Lowe had posed the question to us, what getting a PhD would mean for our family, for myself, and for my community at large. And for me personally, it's an accomplishment in and of itself to say that I have a PhD. I'm the first one in my family to attend any form of higher education, let alone get a PhD. I would be the first in my family to do that. But also, I think it's a gateway. It's like an open door. It opens a lot of opportunities, not just for myself, not just for my family, but for, you know, those who are around me. I think earlier today that they were talking about social mobility, and someone said that it's really, to them, they think it's a state of mind, and I can't say I necessarily disagree. I do think a lot of times, because, like for me personally, it is a state of mind. Sometimes it's not so much that we don't have access to things, but we don't think we can do it. We don't see how we can do it, so automatically it closes it off. And sometimes we need to see examples of people like us or people who came from the same place we came from doing it to know that we can. So for me, I mean, being in the McNair program, I've seen previous cohorts, previous students accomplish major things. Students who also had no research experience, who are also first-generation students, who also had no clue about the grad school process. I've seen them make it and have all kinds of scholarships, fellowships, grants, you know, universities accepting them left and right. And to me, I'm like, well, if they can do it and they're coming from where I'm coming from, then I can do it too. And I'd like to provide that example for my younger siblings, for other adults who don't, you know, who are coming from the same place I'm coming from, and for just my community in general. And I just want people to know, I mean, not everyone's gonna go down the path of higher education. It's not for everyone, but I'd like everyone to know that if they choose to, and if that is for them, they can do it. And, you know, if I could do it, I don't see why you couldn't. So, basically what I'm here to discuss is the TRIO programs in general, just give you an overview of all of the programs, and then my fellow scholars will go more in depth about the McNair Scholars Program. The first program, like Michael was saying, basically these programs exist to provide an entry point at every level and support at every level for these students. And it's basically all about seamless education involving the family, involving the community, basically covering all the bases so that not only do we get in, but that we continue on forward and go on into higher education. The first program is called the Upward Bound Program, and it prepares high school students for success in college. And I think you guys have the AIM Higher Program. To me, it sounds very similar. A lot of the purposes are similar. And basically what they do is they provide a summer instructional component where they take foreign language classes, they have counseling, cultural events. They're basically exposed to college life and activities and just given the opportunity to see what it's about for themselves. There's also Upward Bound for Math and Science and Upward Bound for Veterans. Also, we have the Educational Opportunity Center, known as EOC, and it basically assists low-income adults, first-generation college students. It helps them to gain access to education in general, and it helps them through the financial aid process, which can be daunting if you don't know what you're doing. Also, we have the Student Success Services, which helps low-income, first-generation, disabled students, amongst others, and students also have limited English proficiency. It helps them by, I guess, facilitating opportunities that will help them stay in college, so more about retention than anything. And then finally, of course, we have the McNair Scholars Program, which is what we're all a part of. There are over 200 institutes across the U.S., and currently it serves 5,400 students. And, yeah.
My name is Emily Madrino. I am currently an undergraduate studying biology at the University of Kansas, and that is located in Lawrence, Kansas. It's considered a mid-sized public research university, and it was established in 1866, and currently there are about 30,000 students enrolled right now. My research topics, I started out interested in animal behavior, and I did a research project on social interactions and dominance relationships, but lately I've been leaning more towards the environmental sciences, and now I will be applying to PhD programs in the fall for environmental policy and conservation. As far as what a PhD will mean for me, I grew up in a really small town in western Missouri. And for most of the students that attended my high school, just graduating with a high school diploma was a tremendous accomplishment. A few went on to go to four-year universities, but anything higher than that was almost unheard of. So when I arrived at KU, McNair was really the first opportunity that I had to learn about higher education. I had no idea how to apply to grad school, what graduate school even entailed. So McNair was really helpful in teaching me about what I needed to do in order to further my education and have that opportunity available to me for my future. Like I said, very few students from my high school attended university, and so I, like Lucy said, I would really like to be a kind of role model or an encouragement for them to know that just because people don't expect you to do it or they don't expect that you will achieve anything academically, that doesn't mean that you can't do it if you don't really want to. And there are resources out there, like the McNair Scholars Program, that will help you do it if it's really what you want. We keep talking about McNair. He was a person, actually. His name was Ronald McNair. He was actually the second African-American to fly in space. He was a first-generation college student, much like the scholars that you see in front of you. He earned his Bachelor of Science degree in physics at North Carolina A&T, and then he went on to get his PhD from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Unfortunately, he was on the Challenger space shuttle, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with, exploded shortly after takeoff in 1986, killing everyone on board. And shortly after that incident, the U.S. Congress decided to create the McNair Scholars Program as a way to honor his legacy and provide an opportunity for low-income, first-generation college students to go on and earn a higher degree.
Thank you. So everyone can hear me. My name is, as it was said before by Mr. Hudson, Esteban Santis. I'm from the University of Central Florida. I'm currently an undergraduate student, also heading into my last year. I'm studying literature, and I don't want to say specialized, but I study South American literature and try to do a comparative analysis with North American literature. And that will be also my plan for grad school. And I also intend to get a PhD, a doctorate, if I'm lucky. But yeah, so just real quick, to give you a quick glance into what the program has meant for me. Although I'm not first generation, I am from an underrepresented group, and because of that, I do feel that growing up in the United States, that there was, although, you know, civil rights movement happened in the 1960s, growing up still right after that, you still feel as if not much is expected of you, which it can go either way. Either you fall into that stereotype where, okay, well, I don't have to do anything, or you try to achieve more. Do it. That's what I'm doing. So it works out. Anyway, so the McNair program is giving me guidance, and that's the most important part of it. It's guidance in the form of knowledge, guidance in the form of advice, in the form of graduate school visits. And although I've always wanted to go to graduate school, there was a point in which I really did not know what I was doing. And the McNair Scholars Program showed me what I need to do to get to that stage. Now, just to dive into the McNair Scholars Program, let me talk to you guys about eligibility and also the application process. Eligibility, as you guys have heard, we're talking about first generation, low income, underrepresented groups, or non-traditional students, if you so want to call them. That's what the McNair Scholars is reaching out for. Now, there's other eligibility. For example, I know that in our program, to be eligible, you have to have a 3.0 grade point average, which will be equivalent out of four points. It will be equivalent to a B or A between letters. So it's high. So each one of my fellows, or every McNair Scholar, is academically talented and gifted. Now, that's one. And then you guys have 60 credit hours, which basically translates to having completed 2 years of undergraduate and having 2 years left. Now, that you'll later see why that is when we discuss structure. Now, you have to be a U.S. citizen or a legal resident of the United States. And let's see. Other than that, the most important thing, I believe, is having the desire to want to go to graduate school and attain a PhD, which is what, as you've seen, we all want. Now, the application process, it very much mirrors what, in the United States, the graduate school process. So before applying to a program, we all need letters of recommendation from faculty in our field. We also need a letter of recommendation from someone that is willing to act as a support system for us. So not necessarily a faculty, it could be anyone. It could be a family, a relative, if you like. Now, you also have a graduate school statement. So you basically outline why you want to go to graduate school. And you also have to do a research statement. You have to do your, you basically have to say, although it's not set in stone, but you have to propose what you want to do in the future, what you want to study, although it does change. But that's how the application is, and basically it just gets everyone ready for what they will have to do for graduate school. And if you can't do that, or if you find that that's too difficult, it's indicative of what you will be doing later. So if you don't want to do it, perhaps graduate school wouldn't be the right choice. And with that,
hello everyone. Tony said earlier, my name is Jessica Casebuyer. I also attend the University of Kansas with Emily. I am currently majoring in psychology, and I'm getting a minor in human sexuality. My research interests have actually shifted a little bit, and so I'm interested in women and gender studies. My current research topic will be on the social and institutional barriers for gay and lesbian students in higher education, and basically what institutions are doing to combat those barriers. My grad school plans are to hopefully get a PhD in women and gender studies. And what the PhD will mean for me and my family and my community. I also come from low income, and I'm a first generation college student in my family. And I kind of grew up with the mentality of, as my father liked to put it, they call it work for a reason. And so that basically means, you know, you have a job to make money. It's, you know, it's a job, it's something, it's an occupation, it's something that you do so you can earn a living, so you can support your family. And that's kind of, you know, just the mentality that I've had. But then upon entering into college and upon entering the McNair program, I began to realize that, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a job. It can be a career. It can be something that you're passionate about. You can pursue something that, you know, you care deeply about and still make money off of it, which is a big deal, especially for, I think, for people of low income, because, you know, your driving force is to make money to support yourself, because, you know, you see your family struggling and you think, well, you know, I don't want my family to struggle, and so I'll do what I can to earn money. It's okay if I don't like it, because that's the main goal, is to be financially stable. And I think it's really important, and definitely something that, like I said earlier, that the McNair program has showed for me, is that, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be something that you dread going to every day. It can be something that you're passionate about. It can be something that you genuinely want to pursue. And, you know, hopefully you'll make a decent amount of money off of it. So, and hopefully, you know, that seeing, I'm hoping for my community, you know, seeing that I'm pursuing something that I am actually passionate about, something that I enjoy, and will hopefully be, you know, like they said previously, be a role model or be motivation for others to do the same. And I will give you a little overview of McNair's structure. The structure will depend from program to program, and so I'm sure that our program at the University of Kansas is a little different from UCF. But some of the main highlights are, the main component is structured undergraduate research experience. And so each student does their own research project. What that entails is everyone attends a course over the spring semester, just basically teaching them about different research methods. So, you know, maybe qualitative versus quantitative research methods, and just kind of giving them a background as to what research really is and what it entails. And from there, they will determine what specifically they are interested in pursuing and researching. Also find a faculty member to act as their mentor to help them in the actual planning and the actual carrying out of their research. And then at the end of the semester, you will have your completed research proposal, and so saying what you will do over the summer, what research you will conduct. And that will also include having an abstract of what your research entails. Then over the course of the summer is when students actually conduct their research. And then at the very end of the summer, each student will have a finalized research paper and then also present at a McNair conference that their individual McNair programs will sponsor. And then also McNair scholars attend various cultural events throughout the course of the year. Just, you know, different performances going on at the university, and just different events kind of going on in the community. Also mentoring. Each McNair program has an advisor, like what Michael is doing, and we all meet with our mentor every so often. I know for us it's every 2 weeks, so it's a bi-weekly meeting that you have. And so your McNair advisor just helps to see where you're at, you know, see how classes are going, see if you need any help with anything, and just kind of helps to keep up with, you know, what's going on. And it's someone to go to when, you know, you're feeling really stressed, you have exams and papers going on, and, you know, just someone to go to and to talk to. We also have GRE preparation, which goes on during the summer while we're conducting our research. So preparing for postgraduate research exam, or I'm sorry, not research, postgraduate exams to get into graduate school, help prepare for the test there. Also attending conferences and presentations, you know, just going to conferences and presenting your research and helping to get students out there and to get them used to being in a research environment, help them get used to presenting their own research and just helping them build up their resumes. Also helping students with their curriculum vitas and various components of applying to graduate school, and so helping them with their personal statements and helping them with the application process itself. So.
Hey, well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Alma Zavala. I am entering into my senior year at the University of Central Florida, majoring in psychology. I'm currently researching a comparative study of internal barriers minority groups face in higher education, which is based in the UK system as well as in the US system, primarily different minority groups, seeing as a demographic student. My grad school plans include applying to both clinical and industrial organizational psychology, focusing on issues dealing with minorities, since I feel I have more of a connection with that demographic. The significance of a PhD, gaining an education has definitely been a collective effort on both my family and a few select truly inspirational teachers, which did instill in me that sense that I could go on forward and achieve something great for myself as well as for those who helped me along the way. It would be a rare source of pride for my parents, who are actually both construction workers. My dad didn't even finish primary education. He only got to third grade, since they both came from a small rural town in Mexico. So he tells me all the time that he tells his fellow workers, oh yeah, my daughter is a guy at the University of Central Florida. It's such a pain. but he can't help but gloat. He actually, I actually worked for him in the summer at a construction site as an instrumentation helper, because he told me, I want you to be able to know what it is I go through so that you don't go through the same thing. And it really did help me. I could not possibly fathom how deep a connection that would forge between me and him, because it gave me a true sense of what it is he went through. Getting up at 3:30 in the morning to make your lunch, to drive an hour, to get to this construction site, to put on a 40-pound harness, really tough to walk up those 100 feet in the air of steps to get into like these, what they call Hershey's, because it was a power plant. And people look at me now and say, you worked at a construction site? Yes, I loved it, it was amazing. I won't do it again, but it was great for the time that I did. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about the benefits associated with McNair, which are numerous and expand a great spectrum depending on each scholar and their stories and what it means for them. There's definitely an indelible feeling of community and support within each cohort, which is an individual group or a year that goes in at the same time, as well as the program as a whole, because there are first year and second year scholars. And the second year scholars serve as mentors for the first. We have what we call McNair buddies, Mentoria, and they really do help me along, because the barriers that they face don't have to be ones that I do, if they can give me the advice they wish they had back then. We are all given the chance to interact with peers that we can relate to, given that we all experience the same similar concerns and are presented with the same opportunities. We are stressing about taking the graduate records examination, especially now, seeing as they're going to change the format of it. And getting into select schools, it does depend on your geography, although that might not be the holistic process to get in. They do look at other things. It does exclude you if you don't quite make the score they are looking for. So preparation courses are definitely something that are a benefit to all of us. Through the program, we're prepared to confront future challenges involved not only in gaining entrance into these esteemed programs, but succeeding throughout the track and finally culminating into attaining our PhDs. McNair provides resources and opportunities that otherwise would have been more reminiscent of wishful thinking than actual realities. If someone had told me this time last year that I would be Glasgow, Scotland, I might have laughed and said, maybe someday. Well, I have been given that day, and it's more than words can possibly say how thankful I am to be given this kind of opportunity to really grow as a person and to contribute my own story or my own thoughts into academia itself. McNair has helped us learn how to network and establish strong relationships with faculty and staff members who serve as mentors that we might not necessarily have with them. I can't ask someone who didn't pass third grade how I'm going to write a thesis or a dissertation. I cannot ask someone who carries water jugs around a construction site how to ask for recommendation letters. So these are people that have gone through these experiences and can really lend us that kind of support, which otherwise we would have nowhere to turn. Through this experience, we lose that imposter syndrome where we feel from continuous kind of low expectations, oh, don't worry that you're not doing too well, you're not really expected to. Once you're given that kind of mentality, year after year after year, it's okay, you're gonna fail. It's okay, you're gonna fail. What can you really do or think that you're going to fail? So this program really does give you that sense of hope and that sense of confidence within yourself that, no, I'm not going to fail, because you're sent on an equal playing ground with those that have been given privileges that really weren't presented to you.
That's great, thank you very much. Thank you to all of you for speaking so clearly and concisely, giving us a very important background and context to the McNair program, as well as how it operates in practice. And thank you also for sharing your stories with us, your hopes, your aspirations, why it's important to you, to your family, and also to your community, which is what this conference is all about. And thanks to Michael for working with the students. I can be very daunting coming to a conference, but I think it demonstrates the fact that you are true McNairstallers, you're comfortable in front of this audience. Can we throw it open now to colleagues for questions? Steve.
Hi. Thanks, that's really uplifting, really great to hear. I chaired a session this morning talking about barriers to higher education for people from low-income backgrounds. And one of the some really interesting stories, having said it was uplifting, I don't want to bring it all down now, but there were some interesting things that came out there about what one author in this country, Louise Archer, has called cultural suicide, which is when you step outside your cultural context to do what you're doing. And I just wondered, have there been difficulties for you in that sense, in terms of and what would they be? And maybe you could say something about how you overcame them as well, to end on a positive note again.
Surround them a little bit.
Okay. I will answer. My parents, as I said, are both Mexican, so I come from a full Mexican background. And I visited Mexico since I was 3 months, so I'm very ingrained in the culture. And friends that I had since I was a child have now been married for, 6 years? So they get married around 15, 16. Getting an education is seen as a question. When I go to visit my family, why haven't you gotten married? Why don't you have any kids? What are you doing with your life? An education isn't for you. You're not supposed to want to learn. And to me, at first, it was frustrating. How can you want to limit your entire existence, your whole world, into this tiny town when you don't have anything to offer your kids? Because what are those kids going to have? The same thing. They don't get to go to these opportunities. So it's that clash, that constant clash. Although my parents definitely support me. My mom has always told me, I didn't get to do it, but I know you can. I know you can, so I'm going to do whatever it is I need to so that you can move forward. And my extended family sees me more as like curiosity, like they're kind of watching me, like, do we catch her, like, is she falling, like, is she gonna make it? So it's, there's really a tension between what I'm doing and what they expect. They're like, what are you getting from this? Why do you want to do it? So it's hard, it really is hard to go back home, because my parents don't live in Orlando, they live in a place called Indiantown, and nobody knows where it is. I think my parents got lost, and that's why they stayed there. But I'm grateful for that small town mentality, because you want to take care of the people around you, and you have a greater sense of community. So I appreciate that. But in the form of opportunity, like, you work at power plants, you work at a juice factory. Like, there isn't any way to really progress as a person. So it's really being pulled in two different directions. Don't you want your family? Yes, I do. I care about my family. Don't you want to be your own person? Yes, I do. Because in America, it's really about, okay, you're 18, get out of the house. Go do your life. Go create yourself. In Mexico, that's not what it is about. Like, once you hit 30, oh, you want to move? Where are you going? And even then, it's like next door. So it's really different, polar opposite.
And for me, I haven't really experienced any kind of backlash. The only thing is, when it comes to higher education, like, my dad, I go to see him every week, the question is, so how long do you have left? They can't wrap their minds around the fact that I would want to go on. They're like, okay. I'm like, okay, well, I'm almost done with this part, and then I'm gonna go on for 2 more years, and then I'm gonna go on for, 5 or 6 more years. And he's like, and then what, are you gonna get a job? I'm like, and he's like, I just wanna know when you're gonna get a job. I'm like, okay, daddy, it's coming, don't worry, it's coming. So for them, that's the hard part to understand. But, like, as far as me continuing education, like, I think, honestly, they're very proud of it, and, like, I'm not my parents' oldest child. Like, I have 3 older siblings, like, one who's in her 30s, and so I'm not the oldest by any means, and even to them, they look at me, like, one of my sisters wants to go back to school, a lot of times they make me feel like I'm the oldest, because I think in that sense I've accomplished the most, but I haven't gotten any negative backlash from community, from family, from friends. If anything, it's like, you know, it's cool to see you doing that, and it's like, you know, a lot of people be like, I don't think I could do it. And I'm like, listen, I never really thought I was that smart. I don't think it has anything to do with being smart. It's just about hard work and taking advantage of what's before you and seeking out that opportunity more than it is about. Because a lot of people are smart. I, like, my freshman year of college, all my friends were smart. We were all, you know, top of our school. Out of the seven of us, six of us flunked out our freshman year of college. Like, no, five of us flunked out our freshman year of college. And I was like, what is that about? It was just the mentality. It was about, what did you think you could accomplish? Or, you know, did you really think you could do it? And for some of us, we really didn't think we could do it. So it's more about, like I said before, the mentality than anything. But no, not really any negative backlash.
A lot of the students also that we deal with, particularly with African American males, a lot of them feel the peer pressure from their community or their support group that they're selling out by continuing on in education, or that, you know, why aren't they doing some other kind of things? And so we work early on with the students, oftentimes before they even get to even apply to McNair, with some of the different kind of groups on campus, is to really create that support systems and really to kind of have to start educating families and also peer groups about the different opportunities and how that they can start to become role models, you know, within different kind of things. You know, many of the students that have come into the program have gone back, and there's a huge community service element within the program. There's also the ability that students have to kind of go back and share that information with the communities that they come from, so they can kind of continue on and they can pay forward the experience to those that potentially may not have that information or may want that information but are struggling with how that may be perceived within their environment or their community if they continue on with education.
Thank you.
Annika. Can I ask you, how did you know about
I know that I was actually contacted by the program. I believe I received a letter from the program, just kind of because I had never heard of McNair before, you know, before they actually contacted me. But you know, they sent me a letter just saying, you know, we see that you fit the criteria, and we see that, you know, you've had an extensive academic background, and so, you know, would you like to join this program? And so then, you know, I started looking more into it, and so that's how I found out about it. I was actually contacted by the program.
That's the same for me. I received several letters in the mail, and then finally the director contacted me directly via email. And I set up my meeting with her, I had my interview, and within 2 weeks I was in the program. I know that lately our program at KU has been recruiting, and it's been largely word of mouth. So every time we go in for our biweekly meetings, our director will encourage us to talk to our friends, find out who would be interested in the program, and encourage them to come in and talk to her.
Can I just ask you to clarify, maybe when you were contacted, because you're in a four-year degree program.
Yeah, I was contacted the very beginning of my third year.
And I believe I was contacted the same time, very beginning of my third year. So.
As for me, actually, one of my very close friends works in the McNair office. So my sophomore year, my second year of undergrad, she would talk to me about it. You should really do this program. I think you would really benefit from it. Do this program. It's about research. I fought it. I was like, no, I don't want to. It sounds boring. Sorry about that. I don't want to do it. And she's like, come on. I think it would really present to you the opportunities so that you need to get into graduate school. And finally, I was like, okay. I really don't want to because it sounded hard. It sounded really difficult. I was like, I don't know if I can. That sounds like a lot to ask for. I was like, okay. So the beginning of last semester, I applied, and
a lot of it is also doing the outreach where the students are, and so going into those groups that may be underrepresented kind of student organizations that are on there. I'll also go on campus where the students hang out and to talk to them about what their plans are post UCF and have they ever thought of graduate school. And so a lot of it is going out, because traditionally the students are not going to come to us in terms of finding that information. Even if they do pick up a flyer or get an email, it's not something that's part of their everyday conversation. And so it's starting early on, even when they come into the university or even, you know, before, and sending scholars out into elementary schools, also into middle schools, and talking to them. And again, being able for the students to see mirrors in front of the classroom, so that hopefully that they will be able to get that information. And if they decide not to do it, it's because they had that information and they chose not to, rather than not going on based on not knowing it.
Colin?
Just moving on from that, really, do you, through the recruitment process, are there
particular groups that you struggle to get the applications from, really, and how you try to overcome those?
With many other African-American males in the States has been a huge, it's a concern currently right now. And so, again, going to places where the students will hang out and really talking to them about the different areas, bringing in role models and examples of faculty that are of color that can talk about the different areas that they're interested in. And so a lot of it is just kind of building that relationship over time. And then really, talking to the students and also talking to their support systems and their family about the power of what the continuing education can do for them.
So I know we mentioned that, for example, in the beginning, once you become a second year, you become a mentor to a first year. Once you graduate, now you become a graduate mentor to a second year. So you're always you're always mentoring someone else. So you're helping them out through the process. That's expected. You're expected to get a PhD. You're expected to go on to graduate school. I believe you have, the aim is within 10 years to obtain a PhD. And the program keeps checking. They check on the scholars to make sure that that's happening. So it's very much involved. So I know we joke, once you're McNair, you're always McNair. And they're always checking. That's as far as I know. Anyone else?
I think they're starting like an alum support group too. So whenever you graduate from your respective alma mater, they still gather around. But like, you're McNair, I'm McNair.
Yeah.
So it's really just a continued kind of support system. It doesn't ever really go away.
And Michael works hard to set us up with people who are in our majors. So there's a second year who's my mentor, and then there's another scholar from previous years who's in my field, and she has been, I've never met her. I don't know what she looks like. I love her. I love her. So, like, she's helped me with, there's something I had to do for some class, and I had no clue where to start. The way my field is, it's so interdisciplinary, it was confusing to me. She sent me emails, resources. She's like, look at this. She's like, this is what I'm doing. This is where I work. Consider this. This is what I regret. I love her, and I've only communicated with her through via email. So, I mean, that partnership alone has been so help, and she went to UCF, so she knows what professors to avoid. She knows, like, there was a point where I was looking for a faculty mentor. She's like, such and such is a little intimidating, but don't worry about that. They really know what they're doing. They're only doing it for your benefit. So it was really, and it was really helpful.
On the program side, because we're funded through the U.S. Department of Education, we're required to track the students up until the attainment of their PhD. So we're always in contact with the students, and my philosophy is making them serve as agents, and so getting them out to serve as mentors when they're in graduate school. So there's always that element of paying it back and paying it forward, and that way it also helps me keep track of them that they're going. Social media has been phenomenal in terms of doing that. Also, even if they try to escape, they're friends of someone's on some social media site. But it's more important, as the scholars talked about, is that they have those examples in front of them to kind of do that, and so that we're also able to figure out what are some of the challenges that they face in graduate school, so that we can kind of redo our curriculum to address some of those issues, so that they will not potentially have the same kind of hurdles or obstacles along their way.
Just before taking another question, can I just ask Mike to say what progression rates are for McNair scholars, perhaps just at UCF?
Overall, collectively, the McNair program has been the largest influence in the increase in PhD applications, and for underrepresented groups, particularly for our institution, the last 2 years we've had, overall we've had 185 students have gone through the program. We have 85% of students have completed the master's or are currently in graduate school, and the last two cohorts, 95% have gotten fully funded into graduate programs. Several of the students winning some of the largest National Science Foundation graduate fellowships. And so the nice thing also is that as it starts to cycle through, that becomes part of the culture. And so you have students that coming in never understood or realized where their place within graduate education would be, seeing examples and role models. And so that just becomes part of what they know. It's nice that they know nothing else, and so I can use that as an example. But what we also try to create is that sense of family and community. And so at any point in time, regardless of where they come from, their friends, their environment, they know that within the cohort, there's other folks that that share their experience and understand what they're going through. Because they can't tell their friends, you know, it's Friday night, I want to stay home and I want to study, I want to do this. When their friends are calling them or pulling them in different directions, at least the cohort and the scholars have that bond. And the great thing is that it's a sense of community across the country. So obviously we never knew the Kansas scholars until we were here, but again, it was such a kinship because we share a similar experience. And so it's nice that the goal is also wherever they potentially would go in graduate education, there may be some scholars that can also serve as their support systems in graduate school.
So
then
the problem of dropouts, and also it would be interesting to know if they would wait.
Yes, I mean, a lot of it is that once we send, by law, once we spend funds on a student, they're on the books. And so a lot goes into the selection process. Many of the programs have a one-year kind of trial period where they try the scholars out to kind of give them the information that they would need in the hopes that within that year that they can make a determination whether, because obviously a PhD is not for everyone. Also for underrepresented students, being able to articulate in their second year of college, even their third, that a PhD is where they want to go is unheard of even for students who have gone through the process. And so it's really just taking that time to provide that information. We've been fortunate in terms of the students that have come in, we haven't had a lot of dropout because we have a very rigorous kind of intrusive screening process coming in. And also that very early on, we pair the students with someone that can serve as a support system for them. So I know other folks have gone through the process of losing students, but as students kind of go out, it also potentially is seen as a success for them because they've decided that that's not the path that they want to go on, but they've made that decision based on having that information and having the knowledge to make that educated decision that a PhD is not for them, but they're going to continue on with this other road to go from there.
Andrew.
Just a question to the students, really. What sort of contributions or influence have you been able to have on the program itself and its delivery, or if you haven't had any, what would you like to have? What kind of things would you say would make it different or better?
So what have we accomplished as far as this?
In terms of being able to affect the McNair program or contribute to Harriet Rooms.
Well, I work at the office, so if I got paid a little more, that'd be nice.
You're no longer working in the office. Next question.
Just throwing that off. I mean, I think every accomplishment for us is also an accomplishment for McNair. Like, I think looking at previous cohorts, like we said, we're all first years, well, we're going into our second year. So we haven't, not all of us have, some of us come in with no research experience, no clue. And then some of us come in really decorated scholars and have accomplished a lot. But I mean, over time, we work really hard to attain things. So I know for me personally, through the McNair program, I was introduced to a scholarship program that would allow me to travel abroad, which is this component that we're doing now. And through their support, their guidance in writing and whatnot, I won the scholarship. It's called the Gilman Scholarship Award. And through that, I was able to achieve that. So that, when you look at my resume, you can see, she won an international scholarship award. Okay, let's look at her a little bit more. And that also goes back to the McNair program, because I'd never heard of it myself. So I think that accomplishment for me is also an accomplishment for McNair. And as each of us, achieve something like around campus, because through McNair, we become involved in other organizations on campus. For example, there's this thing called Honors in the Major at our school, and it's basically you write an undergraduate thesis, literally. Like, you go through a reading semester, you go through a writing semester, you have a completed work, it goes into a journal, an undergraduate journal on our campus. So that is an accomplishment for us, like I said before, but also for McNair. And then, although maybe, I don't know, the other scholars may be able to say more about it, but although, we are just starting out, second year scholars are so decorated. I mean, they've accomplished so much. Two of our scholars got NSF's National Science Foundation grants. I mean, to me, that's amazing. And every time I see them do something, I'm like, okay, our cohort has got to top that. They have two NSFs, they got to have three. You know, they have, you know, all they got into all the programs they applied into, we got to get to all of ours as well. So, I mean, you know, we're working. Every day we're working, so. And I think everything that we do reflects on the program.
Just to elaborate on that, everything that we do, it also influences the success of the program. If the scholars fail or don't do as well, the program might not be funded. So the success of the scholars ensures that the program continues.
Yeah.
So just that's as long as we're doing well, we also have a program.
Which puts pressure on us to not slack off or to not, you know, play around, not to take this for granted, because, you know, we want this to be available for someone else in the future. So sometimes there's certain things, you know, certain aspects of it. Some of us are really good at math. We don't need GRE math practice. But we're going to come because we may not need it, but someone else may need it. So we want to be there to, you know, to show, you know, like, we have to attend so that this program can continue on for people who are going to need this later on. So a lot of, it's a lot of give and take. It's a lot of, you know, I may not need this, but my fellow scholar may need this, or someone in the future may need this, you know what I mean? So.
It's also about, I mean, like really spreading the word about the program, because as much as I have been inspired and as much as I have been influenced by this kind of program, I'm not going to keep it to myself because I want my fellow peers to succeed just as much as I have. So those incoming freshmen that are coming in or students that I know from my high school, hey, if you get into this school, really think about joining this program. That way they can have these publications or these things earlier in their career, and they can accomplish this even more. So it's really about taking what we learn from this program and then letting others know about it as well. That way the program can continue to grow, continue to be funded, and continue to widen access to higher education.
Other question?
I wanted to ask Michael, does the U.S. government set you strict targets?
Excellent question. It's a four-year grant that institutions are eligible to apply to. So every 4 years, so we're actually getting ready to rewrite the grant and prove that we've done what we needed to. By law, 2/3 of the population of students in your program have to be first generation and low income by federal guidelines, and then the other 1/3 can be from groups underrepresented at what they deem higher education. And a lot of the particulars are on the cards that I passed out and can give that to you. There are standard objectives that we have to meet, and they allow the programs to set the numbers within those objectives. So one of the objectives are for 10 years from graduation that the students must receive a PhD. And you have to go ahead and put in a number that you feel is achievable for your institution and then justify that. Another goal is that the immediate fall after graduation, students must number of students must be enrolled in graduate education. And so, you know, we've set our kind of target high in terms of 76% of our graduates will be enrolled in graduate school the immediate fall after graduation. And that's a lot of work in terms of taking first generation students to being, because many of them want to, you know, afterwards go back to their communities to give back or to do additional things, or just preparing students that may come in later in their career to prepare them for graduate school. And so there's a lot of guidelines that the U.S. Department of Education provides for you in terms of not only who you can accept into the program, but also how you are monitoring those students and the requirements you have to follow up with them.
Just before taking the next question, let me pose a question to you, just to think about, in terms of the UK experience, widening participation to postgraduate study is certainly underdeveloped in terms of policy, and there's people like Paul Wakeling have demonstrated there's a gap in the literature. I just wanted to maybe think about how programs like the McNair Initiative might translate into your own context and setting in terms of maybe a bit of policy import and export, and what the issues and problems might be. Maybe just something to think about, but please, your question.
Yeah, thank you all, congratulations. I'm just wondering, are there any single parents accepted into the program?
Yes, there are students that are at all levels, you know, throughout McNair. There are students that are single parent, also families, that kind of, and so, you know, really what we tell the scholars at the end, the experience will be the same in terms of completion of a research project, understanding of graduate school preparation and awareness, but we create the program, you know, customized for each student. And so, you know, students that come in that are single parents, there's a whole another set of kind of issues that we need to kind of address for that individual. And so, you know, thinking of traveling to experiences, also time away from the family. In my previous institution that I was involved in, were McNair also, a single parent, their child became part of the McNair family. You know, they were at the events, you know, other scholars were helping to tutor that student, child while the scholar was taking part in workshops, and so it was more of a community involvement, and looking at it. We've also had kind of Kids and Siblings Day, where the students are able to bring in either, you know, their children if they have children, or also their own brothers and sisters, so that they can also get an understanding. And so really, the power is that it's customized for each person.
And it's always that second year. Is it always that second year, or?
Students come into the program depending on how the programs are run. The earliest they can come into the program is their second year, and then for some students it's the third year. But the goal is that potentially that institution might have one of the other TRIO programs that we talked about that can take students earlier on, and then they're just passed along into the next kind of program that can assist.
So the institution has to apply for the funding.
Correct.
To have it.
Correct.
And
Michael, how many institutions in the States get funding?
Currently for McNair, there's 200 institutions, but as is in the case of in everyone, funding is getting cut, so we'll see what that may look like for the next process. At the tail end, there's 200 for the McNair program because it's a smaller population. For the other programs, there's a larger scope in terms of the number of institutions that can are awarded the grants.
I just ask, Esteban is the only male here. Is that just a coincidence, or is the gender mix like in Britain? We have more women than young men now entering higher education.
Very, very good observation. In our program, we kind of have a. Recently, we've had more males than we have in the past, but that's been traditionally that what we find is also trying to outreach to males in terms of looking at it. But across the board, what you'll see is there are more females in the program than there are males.
Would you know what the kind of split is?
Within our program, currently right now, we are 60-40 in terms of males and females. Nationally, I'm not sure exactly, but I can guarantee there's definitely more females in the program.
Linked to sort of Tony's comment about how you could take this sort of model into the UK, because I think it's a really important point that we focus very much on getting some of these groups into higher education, but that I've always struggled with the concept of postgraduate education for these very groups, because again there are a number of barriers there. Given that your institution is one of 200 that chooses, if you like, to apply for this funding to run this programme, what do you see as the key business case for your institution to be involved in this programme?
I mean, a lot of it for us is that we talk about being an institution of access, and we have a lot of students that are first generation, and we are looking at trying to prepare students for that next step. In order for us to be truly educators and really practice what we preach is not only preparing students just to go into the workforce, but also preparing students to go into the workforce as potential faculty in the future, also so that we can make sure that there's a diverse level of faculty that are teaching, but also the folks that are doing the research. And that research is looked at from different angles. And so that when we look at our numbers and our diversity within our population, is that mirrored at the faculty level? Is that mirrored in terms of the number of research grants that are coming in? And for our institution, the answer is no. And so really the case is providing an opportunity to kind of create that next kind of that next group.
What percentage of your students go on to study at your institution?
Really, what we've been able to, what we've tried to do is to push them away,
mm-hmm.
To really look at kind of expanding. Of our last kind of cohort that graduated, about 70% went external. What we also try to do is they have a summer experience that they do their research. Typically, for many programs, they do the research at their home institution. Our program tends to send them out, so we have the three that are here with us for this summer, and then the 14 other students that are part of their cohort are across the country doing research at various programs. And what that also does for us is it helps to have that conversation with their family for first generation students of that they've been able to go away and come back and they're still alive and they keep in contact and they have great kind of values and opportunities. But also on the financial side, it also may be more important for that student to stay home because of commitments to family, they're geographically bound because of the children they may have, and so we work to kind of figure out what's the best situation for them.
I was wondering about sort of the exponential effect. Because you're there, do you feel that maybe the other students who maybe aren't on making their project are getting some benefits from seeing the role modeling, from seeing that if they're not in the program and being supported by the program, perhaps they're still getting some of the benefits from being around?
There might be asked some of the students to comment on that, and maybe Mark and Mark wants to come in as well.
I think we're able to give them a more realistic view at what, like in my major, we have to get a master's degree. Like, you don't, there's not really very much to do with a bachelor's degree. And I think a lot of us have unrealistic ideas of what it takes to get into a master's program, and we don't realize how competitive it is. So a lot of times, you know, we all have to go through, like, we all have to take the GRE. So, you know, I know we've done this in our cohort. They may not be taking the same course that we're taking because we take a preparatory course. They may not take it, but then we'll be like, okay, after we come from class, we can go to the library together and we study together as a group. And these are the study methods. I mean, there's faculty at UCF. There's a faculty member who's going, she's trying to go on and get her PhD. And she is about to take the GRE this summer as well. So we meet up with her and we study with her. I mean, you know, I think whatever benefits we get, we pass them along. And even if they don't directly, like, you don't have to be part of the McNair program to do undergraduate research. You don't have to be part of the McNair program to, you know, go and talk to faculty and create a better relationship with them. I mean, that helps get facilitated for us. And as we learn more, like I tell my peers, you know, anybody who I know, I'm like, oh, you know, I know this professor personally because of this, that, and the other. And I'm like, if I were you, I would just go to their office hours. Just make up a question. Go. Just talk to them because you want to get to know them. So I think in that sense, you do, even if you're not part of the program. And that was one thing Michael asked us when we were going through our interview process. They asked us, if you don't get into the McNair program, do you intend to go on anyway? And do you intend to go on and get a PhD anyway? And for most of us, we talked about it today as well, the answer is yes. We might not, it wouldn't be as easy, but we still want to go on, and we want to make the opportunity available for everyone, even if you're not in the program. So.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I know many of the people in my major, or even in my group of friends, they see all of the things that I'm doing. They see me participating in research, going to different conferences to present the research that I've done, and they want to know how they can the same things, and I'm able to tell them different ways that they can get involved and kind of improve their chances of getting accepted into graduate school because I've had the experiences that McNair has been able to give me. So I've been able to help a lot of people kind of figure things out. Even though they're not in the program, they still get the benefits from it.
I think being in the program, we're exposed to a lot of other programs. So I have friends who know they don't want to get a PhD, but I'm like, well, do RAMP or do President's Leadership Council, join SGA, you know, do all these other organizations that will help you, even if it's not a PhD, even if it's just a master's. For some people, that is a terminal degree. Or if it's just, you know, building up your resume, figuring out what you want to do, you know, just get out there.
On the university side, the success of the program has also helped to change the conversation about how funds are allocated on our campus for access to students, because they've been able to see the success, and you know, the board of trustees and all the people, you know, alumni are interested in the story. So that has helped to kind of bring the conversation about underrepresented students more to the forefront in terms of access and how different programs will be funded on the campus.
Maybe just a bad formulated question. Let me ask a question about how important is an international experience to you, like you've got now, to you as McNair scholars?
I think it's really important. For, you know, Emily and I, we are the first two McNair scholars in our program to ever have done anything like this, as far as, you know, doing an internship internationally. And I think that's huge. And, you know, it shows other McNair scholars that, you know, yeah, it's great, you know, what we're doing now, but we can expand further. You know, you don't have to just stay in the U.S. You can go internationally. You can go anywhere you want. And for us, the process of trying to get here was quite a battle. It was definitely a process. But, you know, with the help of our McNair advisors and, you know, with some teamwork and some optimism, you know, we made it work. And I think that's a really great example for other McNair scholars, is that, you know, if there's a program out there, if there's something out there that you want to do, like, you can do it. And, you know, I think it was a good example of, you know, you just have to get creative and you have to, you know, find other means, and it's not going to be easy, but it's attainable. And so I think that's a big accomplishment for us.
In my opinion, my point of view, it's from where I come from, it's unheard of, really, to be able to travel outside of Florida, much less to come to Europe. Speaking with my family before coming here, they really didn't believe me. They're like, oh, okay, you're going to Europe. But I send them pictures, and they're sending me messages like crazy. Why didn't you tell us you were going to Europe? I did tell you. You laughed at me, you remember? So it's really like that sense of like unreality. Like, how can you go? It's way too expensive to go. You have to stay here because you have to work so that you can pay for school. And you have to do all these things. You can't do things that we couldn't do, because we don't have the means to send you and do this program. Like, we can put this then on our resumes, on our CVs. We presented at an international conference. And to be coming from a background like ours, to have those kinds of credentials is amazing, really, to help further us into our processes of getting into graduate school, because it's just that one more caveat of something different, really, and not something that I would have thought possible, and like I said, I'm really grateful for.
Even just the conversation back home for the students that hadn't come, and also the students that are participating in the program, you know, for the scholars to tell them that, you know, they spent some time in Amsterdam, they climbed the Eiffel Tower in Paris when we were there, and then to be now here in the UK, I mean, it's an amazing experience. It changed their life. Last year was the first year that we started the international collaboration, and we took a group of students to Croatia, and we had one scholar who was first generation female in political science, and international relations was her focus, but she had never been outside the country, and she was looking to kind of go into an area that, you know, all of the programs that she was competing with, all the students had spent time abroad. You know, they were legacy students where they spend their summers doing the things. Because of her experience in Croatia and visiting the embassy there, she was able to come back and get some very sought-after internships, and then went on to win the U.S. Pickering Fellowship that funds her, fully funded for her master's, and guaranteed a three-year placement in the Foreign Service afterwards, and then continuing on for a PhD. That experience would not have been possible for her without that international experience. And for us, particularly on the director side, for students that are going to be part of future faculty, you know, it's not enough for them just to understand the research, you know, from the lens of the U.S. lens. The students they're going to teach, as you all well know, are coming from many different cultures, from different perspectives, and so to be able to kind of have this experience, I know for the scholars will ever change them, but also as they move forward in terms of their stories and the legacies they create, that international experience will definitely carry forward with them.
And I think we feel more knowledgeable and cultured, like I'm known for saying I don't like to talk to adults, they make me nervous. And let alone adults from other countries, I'm gonna say something offensive, for sure, I know it. But it's like to get out there and to be networking with y'all, to be, you know, have an opportunity to speak, to learn, like about, you know, last night we were learning so much about this culture, about everywhere we visit, someone tells us something that we didn't know. So it's like that exposure, you know, that doesn't directly relate to my research topic, but that's like, it like such valuable information that I might not be exposed to back home, that I might not get, you know, I wouldn't know how to interact with someone who's not like me. So it's like to have common ground gives you an opportunity to talk, to build a network, to build a relationship that otherwise you wouldn't have an opportunity to develop. So.
Maggie, thank you.
Like there are various like resources that you can, grants and scholarships and fellowships. I didn't know what a fellowship was, or like a research assistant. Like there's many ways to get around it, but if you have to take out a loan, in the end it will pay off. So even then, although it is daunting now to think of, because recently there, like with all the budget cuts that they've had on education, we have a scholarship called the Bright Future Scholarship for Florida, where if you go through certain programs, such as I did the International Baccalaureate Program, or you get a certain score on your SATs, then you're fully funded for those 4 years, so you don't have to pay anything. It's called 100% Bright Futures, and I did win that award, but with the cutting back, they suddenly, last year they told us, okay, well, you know how we told you that we're gonna fund you for 4 years? Just kidding, it was only 2 years, and now it's only a certain percentage of each credit hour that they're paying. 100% is now, what, 190 per credit hour, approximately, so there is a certain gap now. I've had to work through my college experience, which does affect my studies, because every minute, every hour, every day that I'm not, like, that I'm working is a day, minute, hour that I'm not studying. And the fact that I can still progress definitely speaks about, because I know like I'm not the only one, and I have numerous, or all of my colleagues have to work as well. And it really does speak about the fact of how much input we put into our studies while we're working or taking care of family, because my summers aren't mine. It's not the time for me to have fun, really. It's time for me to go back home, and if I'm not working, I'm taking care of my siblings, because I'm the oldest of four sisters and the oldest of 26 grandchildren, and those are all my kids. I take care of them too while their moms and dads go to work. So it's difficult, but it's like it's not something that you have to do by yourself. This program definitely opens up opportunities. If you need funding, here, talk to this person, because they are the chair of this organization, which can then give you grants for these kind of things, like just books or board, or getting to a level within the institution that you're applying to get fully funded through them. And usually the more expensive universities are the cheapest to attend to, because they are more fully funded by the government or private sectors, and then thus can give their graduates or their incoming students more of assistance with funding.
I'll give you some perspective as well. I've had to work full-time throughout my undergraduate career. I don't have to do it any longer, but I did as I started out, which is if anyone's going to fail, you're going to fail in this first year, so it's a little bit difficult. I'm also in debt. I'm $10,000 in debt. So education is not free. Tuition is increasing also. We're having the same...
15%.
Tuition is increasing in the United States. In our institution, also, it's increased by 15% for next semester. It increased 15% last semester. Yeah, education is not getting any cheaper. People are not making more. So, but you said one message, because you would think that would be enough to discourage anyone. If it was easy, it wouldn't be worth it. It wouldn't. So I would say just,
there's always a way.
Yeah, there's always a
there's
way.
Always a way. You just have to really work together.
I'm not saying it's easy. I owe money.
And I mean, the point of us doing all of this at this level is to make our resume, our CVs competitive. We want to be competitive with others who have had better opportunity. I mean, going in, someone not even looking at, any minority anything, just look at my application. Look what I've done. Look at the work I've accomplished. I've shown that I can, I've written a thesis at the undergraduate level. I can do it at the graduate level. You know what I mean? It's just building our resumes and our CVs to show that we are capable of doing this, And, when they see potential in you and they see you're capable, they're more likely, okay, so we know you're going to make it through. Here you go. We can fully fund you. You are, competitive. You are a competitive applicant. So
I think also as far as finances go, we're all from low-income families anyway, so finances are a problem to begin with. So we have the choice to either not spend the money on college but struggle financially for the rest of our lives anyway, or go ahead and spend a little bit more to get our education and then have the opportunity to better ourselves and make things better for our families in the future.
And also I think going along with that, I mean, not only bettering, ourselves, but also bettering our community. Because I feel that, the more educated your community is, the better your community is, the more opportunities you have. And so I think just even as in a broader perspective, it's not just an individual thing, but you're contributing to your society, you're contributing to your community. And so I think, just also in just a broader perspective.
I think we've got time for a couple more questions.
Right. I think one of the really interesting things about the AIR program, once we actually hear about it, it just becomes so obvious why it's so important. The thing we're going to have in the UK is my institution, a lot of people from low-income backgrounds, from a lot of unrepresented groups study. We would love to do something like the AIR program. We're not going to have the benefit for a number of years of the government program to do it.
Go along and ask you to sort of pick out what you think is key for you.
Faculty mentors, for sure. Interaction with faculty. I never, like I said, adults make me nervous. So, adults, But I never really had. If I didn't have to talk to my faculty, like any of my professors, I wouldn't. Once I leave class, that part of my day is over and I'm done with that. Because I don't know, I didn't know what to say to them, how to interact with them. But having a faculty mentor has, in some senses, just opened my eyes to the fact that, oh, they're humans. Okay. And to see that, they give me so much advice about their own processes. For us, in choosing a faculty mentor, we had to interview faculty. We were interviewing them, asking them about their process, asking them about how they got to where they were. And to me, that is the biggest deal. I mean, everything else is awesome, great, but to be able to form that relationship with them that translate into letters of recommendation or ideas about where to go. I had no idea. Where do I begin to even, how do I know which grad school to go to, which program to go into, I don't know what my area of research interest is. I don't know. I have no clue. But having someone in my field who's done it, who's accomplished, to give me advice has been just so beyond valuable. I couldn't pay for that. I couldn't pay for that. So for me, that's the biggest deal. Faculty mentors.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I'd say the faculty mentor is probably the most important part of the program. Just because like I said before, we're all first generation college students. We don't have anybody that we can go to talk to about the problems that we're facing with our applications to graduate school. Like I said before, when I started my undergraduate career, I had no idea about anything to do with graduate school. I didn't know what it meant to be a graduate student. I didn't know how you would even go about applying to graduate school. And I was able to talk to my mentor and find out the strategies that he used when he was applying for grad school, and he was able to help me answer all of the questions and find the information that I needed to know in order to fill out my applications and have a chance at getting into graduate school. So it was very important.
Yeah, if you're going to give anyone anything, give them a strong relationship with guidance and encouragement. Because if you can encourage them to go on, you know, you don't have to give them fancy things. Just let them know that they can do it. If you believe in them, a support system, it's what I find most people are lacking. So if you get them a strong support system, a strong base, you can build from that. Now, try it and tell me if it's right. But I bet on it.